Those of you who were here last time may recollect that we considered how the fragmentary approach to life is a source of discord, of trouble, and of the lack of vision. We also considered the question of power in the use of mantras and so forth in various religious disciplines. You know what a mantra is? It is a word or a phrase which is used as a word of power. One repeats the word again and again, believing that it will produce certain effects, certain good effects, of course. And in actual practice, one does get certain results. This is an example of the use of power. But we also saw, or rather tried to see, and I hope we did see, that power is invariably and inevitably misused somewhere, somehow, unless there is the basis of the harmony of love and wisdom in fruition laid down beforehand. Power is not for man to pursue or handle. And as you know, all the great religions of the world have ascribed all power to God. In the Christian teachings we have, "For thine is the power and the kingdom and the glory forever and ever." Thine is the power, not ours. For us, it is essential to become pure, to restore our relationship with the whole, the harmonious whole, the transcendence, holiness, God, if you like to use that word. And restoring that relationship implies that through us there flows transcendent love, unhindered, and in all our life wisdom is manifest. When that is there, then power is never misapplied or misused, either by or through us. It's easy enough to say these things. It is not so easy. In fact, it is very difficult to see all their implications in our everyday life. We are caught in this trap that we ourselves are imperfect to start with. And our everyday life necessitates incessantly the use of power. To speak a word, to think a thought, to perform an action, to carry out a procedure, to do one's job, entails the use of energy. Power in action. You can't get away from it. See? And being imperfect, we are constantly misusing it. Power is utilized in all those ways which will bring about a self-oriented, a preconceived fulfillment, which always means we use power to enable us to fulfill, to satisfy our pleasure drive first and foremost, to satisfy all our egoistic urges, all our assertions of self separate self as against a hostile universe. Sometimes the question is raised, what about those who give themselves up totally to great causes? But look very deeply into that, and you will see that power is invariably and inevitably misused in some degree or other, in some respect or other, in all the best causes. We have, of course, the terrible, glaring examples of established religions behaving with unparalleled cruelty and horror, that is, misusing their power to inflict upon others. You see, in the name of God. We have the great religious wars, the persecutions, inquisitions, this, that, and the other. So power is always misapplied. If one completely renounces, abjures the use of power, that is to say, abjures it in the sense that one remains awake all the time, not to let it be self-oriented, then one perhaps does the least amount of harm in the world. To be harmless is the indispensable prerequisite for love to flow through that person. The person cannot deliberately love. Not one of us can deliberately love. All that we classify under the word love, knowingly and consciously, is an attachment, a desire to possess, a desire to, if not to possess, to extract satisfaction by giving to the other. It's a pleasure drive in some form or other. This is very, very important. When we are really harmless, then love flows through us and we don't know it. It is beyond definition. It is beyond all limitation and restriction. And then there is true fruition for love. Now this is very intimately tied up with power. And it is the same with wisdom. There is no such thing as true wisdom in operation unless the individual has renounced power. Power is oppressive. Love gives. Wisdom maintains equanimity, that state of poise and balance which ensures a stable harmony of the universe. And under those circumstances, power is creative action. Then power creates. Now, of course, the word, thought and speech, the word is a tremendous instrument of power in our human life. It is probably the most powerful instrument of power, the strongest instrument of power. The word. And as we all know, the word is intimately linked up with what we commonly call thought. We commonly call thought, as the Buddha himself declared, is an activity of speech. Discursive thinking, silent speaking, is what we commonly call thought. Now I'm going to say something which may help us to enter deeper into this, into the actual situation of existence. Man is transcendence thinking. Now, let that go right in. Don't try to make meanings. Just let the words as such go right in. Man, capital M, capital A, capital N. Man is transcendence thinking. But it is perfectly obvious in this context that transcendence doesn't use words as we use them. Transcendence doesn't speak any human language or a non-human language. Now, what is the meaning of thinking? What is the meaning of thought in this context? You can't imagine it, but you can perhaps sense it. You can perhaps thrill to it, that is all. Thought and thinking in this context represents power action hyphenated, which means instantaneous creation. The whole existent universe is the product, the appearance of transcendence thinking. God or Brahman or Atma, use whichever word you like, or the infinite or the absolute, thought. And that thought is the existent, the appearance of transcendence. The created universe. Now, I don't want to go into any sort of speculative realm. Come back to the first word I used, man. Man is transcendence thinking. The word man, from its Sanskrit root man, means to think. And if we now remove the word man and leave transcendence thinking, you will see that transcendence thinking, which produces the whole universe, has produced man. Not man, the creature that you and I know and call Homo sapiens, not merely that, but the totality. The totality is man. Now be very careful, don't read from this man, I myself here, you yourself here, to a kind of a superman. Feel it the other way about. The thought of the transcendence is total creation, and total creation is man, of which you and I are this particular kind of representative of man. Have you got that? But you see, this sort of thing is said by me here. This kind of man says that about man. But have I any option to say otherwise? It's not possible for me, a man in the shape of Homo sapiens, to say anything else in words. But there's a tremendous significance to this. Homo sapiens, like any other creature or thing in the universe, is the embodiment of the absolute. We are transcendence embodied. And our link with transcendence is this extraordinary faculty which we have, not shared by other creatures, the faculty of speech, of the word, and the succession of words, which is our mode, which we name thinking. But if and when Homo sapiens, this man, becomes the totally purified one, the totally related one to the whole cosmos, then this man, Homo sapiens, his thought will be creative action, power in perfect operation. So you see, actually, this idea, this teaching of the word and the power of the word is a teaching of tremendous significance. And it should awaken us to the outstanding importance of understanding the nature of the words we use and the tremendous importance of making all our speech wholly true, loving, good, beautiful, and useful. Because power brings into manifestation, hence the utility aspect.
This one, Mr. Jeffries, you take straight to Arthur, I think. Follow you around.
What has been taught through the ages as control of speech, I think, has this sort of reality as its root, as its basis. Control of speech is no different from control of what we call thought, discursive thinking. Control not in the sense of repression, but bringing to perfection. Now, if we awaken to that, we can begin to disentangle the slavery of our intellect to desire. We can begin to perceive truly and to think truly. All our thinking is in the service of desire. We don't know it, but it is completely tied up with desire. If you pursue any thought process for even a minute during our daily life, if you really examine it, assuming that we can examine it, that we are intelligent enough and serious enough to examine it, we will find that all that thinking has been tied up with desire and the fulfilling of desire. This is not to suggest desire is evil. Desire in itself is no evil. But my desire is, on the whole, the, probably 95 to maybe 99% of it is evil. Why? Why is my desire evil? Because I am aware of everything through the medium of my discriminative consciousness, vijnana, which is tainted with greed, hate, delusion, ambition, envy, jealousy, pleasure-seeking, ego-asserting, etc. This is the reason. You see? One has to let this really go through and through one's being. Let all the 15 billion cells of the body awaken to the fact of this. The dis-ease of the living organism, the psychophysical organism, is present because it is in a state fundamentally of discord. Discord because of my ignorance, because of my lack of insight, because of my state of imbalance, unquiet. And peaceful. Now, the word plays a tremendous part in the story of our life. From the time we are born, we learn to name things, to name actions, to name qualities, to name aspirations, desires, virtues, transcendence, immanence, anything and everything, the name. And all the time, the naming process is the greatest driving power behind us. Fundamentally, how does it go wrong? We are so conditioned from infancy that when we name an object, we are aware of the object as something separate from the rest of the universe. I say chair, table, saucepan, bus, car, house, Tom, Dick, Harry, Jane, Mary, and they are all separate from the one total reality in which we are all completely contained, don't I? When I say chair, I'm conscious only in terms of chair, but unconscious of the room which contains the chair. I separate it out in my mind, and only separate it out. I'm unconscious that the room is contained within the house, which is contained in London, which is contained in the planet. There is a positive power going out from me to preserve and maintain the separation. And this is the root of conflict, of origin. The origin of discord. See? Now, if when I name something, an object or a person, or when I name a procedure, an action, an activity, when I use nouns, verbs, and all the rest of it, if in addition to my aware, because through my discriminative consciousness of that particular thing in itself, I'm also aware of the full relationship of the particular to the general, the totality, then the naming process is no longer a source of hate, resentment, conflict, destruction, evil. And if I'm conscious of totality in that way, aware of particularity and its relationship to totality, then I'm in the harmless state. I'm in the state in which there is no selfness, there is no self-orienting. Otherwise, that chair is my chair, this chair is my wife's chair, that chair is my friend's chair, and so on, all those absurdities come into being. It's all self-oriented. And oh, the lovely oneness of that living organism, the universe, is dismembered. Just broken to bits, wounded. So you see, the word and the pattern of several words, many words, which makes thinking is a magic. It's a power. But understand every word and be awake to every word in its total relationship, its complete relationship to the totality. And then the word is pure. And the word is a power for good. Then it is a mantra in the true sense of the word mantra, the word of power. I remember 40, 50 years ago hearing this sort of prayer being offered, calling upon the Lord to come once again amongst men and speak the word of brotherhood, which shall make the warring nations cease from strife and follow the ways of peace. But the transcendent can speak that word, and lo and behold, it is there. That is why Genesis says, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. The word. Transcendence thinking is power action, instantaneous creation. And that is the, as I see it, the total meaning, the full meaning of the word man. Now, if we practice japa, which is the use of the word, the repeating the holy word or the holy phrase again and again, in order to bring about a spiritual result for our own good, or, if you like to expand it, for the good of the particular society or religious community or this, that or the other, but this is merely a case of self-identifying oneself with a larger whole. If one does it that way, one is misusing it and nothing happens. It is self-oriented. You see, japa is something which has come down certainly for at least three or more thousand years, in India anyway. But the mass of the people use it self-centeredly. They believe that by repeating the word, the name of God, Ram, 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 etc., you see, all their sins will be wiped out and they will get a free ticket into Nirvana. You see the absurdity of it. Now, let us just have a brief look at the Upanishads, those Upanishads which deal with this question of japa, mantra. This comes from the Tarasara Upanishad. Tarasara means to cross over, the happy crossing over, the meaningful crossing over. You see? Brihaspati asked Yajnavalkya, and the name of Yajnavalkya is one of the big names. It's as big as the Buddha or Jesus. Brihaspati asks him, that which is called Kurukshetra is the place of the sacrifice of the devas and the spiritual seat of all beings. Kurukshetra is the name of the battlefield in India, where the famous Mahabharata war is supposed to have taken place. And the Gita, those of you who have studied it at all, the Gita starts off with that wonderful scene there on the battlefield at Kurukshetra. You see, Arjuna feels despondent, throws away his weapons and speaks to Krishna, his charioteer. Krishna, the Lord of the universe incarnate, as he is presented. Kurukshetra is the battlefield, the place of conflict. There is an actual place, there's an actual region in northern India named Kurukshetra. There's a station there on the road, on the railway journey from Delhi to Amritsar and all that part. You see, you come to the station, which is named Kurukshetra. There is that field where this battle actually did take place historically. Some sort of little battle, it must have been a little shindy, of course, in the usual way. But of course, the poets and the teachers utilize this little historical event as a peg on which to hang the magnificent cloak of their teachings, you see. Very convenient. However, Kurukshetra then. Therefore, where should one go in order that he may cognize Kurukshetra? The place of the sacrifice of the devas and the spiritual seat of all beings. Different interpretation of Kurukshetra, isn't it? The place of sacrifice of the devas, the shining ones, the excellent ones, the devas, those who have achieved. It includes human beings also, of course. You see? I mean, the Shakespeares and Beethovens and such like are all devas, the shining ones. You see? This is one of the meanings. To which Yajnavalkya replied, Avimukta. Avimukta is a name for Banaras, the holy city. Kashi, the holy city. Avimukta, the holy city, the holy place, is Kurukshetra, the place of the sacrifice of the devas and of the study of Brahman. Because it is there that Rudra, the third person of the Trinity, named ordinarily named Shiva, when named Rudra, it means the roarer, he who roars. Zeus the Thunderer. You see? That's the idea. Initiates one into the crossing over, the Taraka.
This is an ordnance survey.
Through this, one becomes immortal and the enjoyer of moksha, liberation. Therefore, one should always be in the midst of that place, avimukta, and should never leave avimukta, the holy place. See?
Right on the river, of
course? Thus said Yajnavalkya. Then Bharadvaja asked Yajnavalkya, what is Taraka, crossing over? What is that which causes one to cross this mundane existence? That is to say, what enables one to cross over from the worldly consciousness and the worldly awareness of our daily life into the transcendent awareness of it? That is the real meaning. To which Yajnavalkya replied, Om Namo Narayanaya is the crossing over. This is the spell, the mantra, Om Namo Narayanaya. And of course you will find thousands of devout Hindus to this day who will, perhaps they'll be sitting by the riverside mumbling to themselves, either softly or quite silently, Om Namo Narayanaya, Om Namo Narayanaya. All very pleasant, all very nice. But how many of them really know how to speak the word? Now, here is the instruction. This Taraka, this mantra, should be worshipped as Chid Atma. Chid is consciousness. The completely awakened attention. That is Chid. Chid Atma. The ultimate reality in the state of complete awakenment. That is Chid Atma. Om is a single syllable and of the nature of Atma, the absolute reality. Nama is of two syllables, and it is of the nature of prakruti, matter. Now you see, two transcendence, the absolute, we ascribe oneness. To matter, manifestation, we ascribe two-ness. We cannot ascribe oneness. Because only through the interplay of at least two can, and what we commonly call the objective material universe, come into being and carry on. It would stop. If we ever arrived at complete oneness, that would be the end of any objective manifestation. So, matter, two, and so nama. Om, of course, is the meaningless sound, just the magical sound. There is no meaning in the sense of a dictionary meaning to the word Om. No dictionary meaning. Nama means salutation, you see. And Narayanaya is the dative case of the name Narayana, which is... Narayana is practically almost the exact equivalent in Hinduism to God, the personal being, the father, the creator of Christianity. Narayana. And the dative case is Narayanaya, to Narayana. You see? So Om Namah Narayana means Om, salutation to God. That's what it means in as far as the language goes. Narayanaya is of five syllables and is of the nature of Brahman, or Parabrahman, as he says here. He who knows this becomes immortal. But knowing is not our ordinary common garden human meaning of knowing. Through Om, now listen. Through Om is Brahma produced. Brahma, the first person of the Trinity. God the Father, the Creator. Through Na is Vishnu produced, the Sustainer, the second person of the Trinity, the Preserver. Through Ma, Nama, the two sounds, you see, is Rudra produced, the third person of the Trinity. Through Na, the name in the name Narayanaya, is Ishvara, wait a minute, I'll get the right word. The limited, restricted, personal God idea. Ishvara. God as a being separate from everything else. A chap. That is Ishvara. Mind you, the wielder of power. Ishvara. Through Ra is the under-Virat, or Virat of the universe. Virat is a very difficult concept to explain. It would take rather long. I'll leave it out for the moment. Someday we'll talk about this Virat. If we go into what is another Upanishad known as the Paindala Upanishad. See, there again Yajnavalkya is the teacher. And Yajnavalkya is also the teacher in the great Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. He's known as the Yogeshwara, the prince of all yogis. Through Ya, Purusha, the person, is produced. Now, person has a very interesting meaning in the Upanishadic context, Purusha. When we translate it into English as person, we think of person in the sense of John Brown is a person, Mary Smith is a person. It's not in that sense at all. The Upanishad, of course, gives hopelessly bad philology. And from the standpoint of philology, it is nonsensical. But from the standpoint of truth, it is true. The Upanishad puts it this way. Purusha, they derive in this manner. Purva, meaning formerly, and the root ush means to burn up, and the implication is to burn up all evil. He who has previously burnt up all evil is the Purusha. In other words, the perfected Holy One, in complete relationship with totality. That is the meaning of person. What a marvelous meaning of person. He who has burnt up all evil, the Holy One in complete harmony with the totality. This is the meaning of person. This is your personality and my personality. And look what we've made of personality in the world. Look at the pathetic, ugly, stupid images that everyone displays, especially all the so-called famous ones who are interviewed. And quite truthfully, they talk in terms of, oh, they have to live up to their image. Exactly. Dead dodos. Now, through Ya, Purusha is produced. Through Na is Bhagwan. Bhagwan, the Lord, the giver, the beneficent one, the auspicious, the fortunate one. the giver of happiness, of peace, of bliss, of heart's desire, in the transcendent sense. What is your name? Any one of you. What is my name? My secret and true name in the land of heart's desire in the transcendent sense. Do you know? It is love. That is everyone's name in the land of heart's desire. Nothing to do with possessing. This heart's desire is nothing which you possess, nothing which you long for, nothing which you gain. It is this transcendent love, the thing that I don't know here. So Bhagwan, the Lord, the giver. And through Ya is Paramatma produced. The Supreme, the Absolute Atma. We start with Atma, we end with Atma. Om Namo Narayanaya. So see what it stands for, this mantra, this word of power, this magic spell. Om Namo Narayanaya. If one understood all this and could transcend all the limitations of mere thinking, verbal thinking, silent talking, and therefore image forming of Bhagwan or of Purusha, etc. What have you got? It is the infinite itself, isn't it? It's transcendence, it's God. It's holy ground. The holiness which is everywhere, which is no restriction, etc. So this is the sort of meaning involved in the use of the mantra. Now similarly, you can use any mantra you like, if you know how to use it. Take the Om Mani Padme Hum, which the Buddhists use. Om Mani Padme Hum. And they use the same word, Om, as the Hindus use. Very interesting. The meaningless sound, which stands for the infinite, both the manifested as well as the unmanifested, as it is said in the Prashna Upanishad. You see? Om Mani Padme Hum. And it is translated as, oh, the jewel in the lotus. But what is this jewel in the lotus? What is the lotus? This. When you sit in the lotus posture, it is the symbol of self-contained holiness. The totality which is all holy. That is the lotus. And what is the jewel? Yourself which is totally unselfed, which is the condition of nirvana. All greed, hate, delusion extinguished. Om Mani Padme Hum. There, if you like, is one of its deep significances. Did Trungpa ever explain anything like that? Trungpa?
No.
Have you ever heard this before?
No, I haven't. I've only read in
Has he presented it this way?
Yes, about the lotus pose and so on. Yes.
Because I've got his. books. I'll have a look again. I remember reading something about it. Yes. Now, there are eight syllables here. Om, Nama, Narayanaya. One, two, and five. Eight syllables. So, this Ashta Akshara, which means the eight-syllable formula of Narayana, is the supreme and the highest Purusha. Thus is the Rig Veda with the first foot or half. That which is Om is the indestructible, the supreme, and Brahman. That alone should be worshipped. It is this that is of the eight subtle syllables. No, reading it like that is hopeless. You must read it for yourself. It took me nearly half an hour to look carefully through that single paragraph and sort of get it properly. Now, the very word Om, sometimes spelled O-M, but its correct spelling is A-U-M. In the Sanskrit form, A-U-M. Not so much M as M. A-U-M. The A is Atma. U is not Atma. Transcendence, thinking, creates the universe. But the universe is something which is projected out of, it is an appearance of Atma. It is itself un-Atma, not Atma, Anatta. This is the true meaning of Anatta. A, Atma, U, not Atma, and Am. The negative relationship between A and O. Now, translate it into ordinary English. The Atma is not not Atma. Atma, not Atma, is not. Heard it? The Atma is not not Atma. Now, how is there any relationship possible? Because transcendence, thinking, power, expresses an appearance. So if there weren't Atma to start with, there wouldn't be any not Atma. You see, the process cannot go the other way. It's a unidirectional process. The manifested universe, the becoming process, cannot create transcendence. Only transcendence can create the becoming process. But don't let's go too much into metaphysics. Now, so A is the first letter, U is the second, M is the third. Bindu, the dot, the point, is the fourth. Nada, sound, is the fifth. Kala is the sixth. Well, she doesn't give any explanation. Kalatita, that's beyond Kala. Atita means beyond whatever goes before it. Kala Tita means that which is beyond Kala, is the seventh. Kala means a particular portion of. It is called Taraka because it enables one to cross this mundane existence. Know that Taraka alone is Brahman and it alone should be worshipped. And then he goes on in that style. The sum of it is just this, that in the single mantra is embodied totality. And if one awakens to totality, but totality in harmonious relationship, in its complete relationship, then the mantra has power. The word. Yes, George?
I believe it's in the Pure Land School where they repeat the word Amitabha, which is the mantra.
And spell that? Spell it?
A-M.
Ah, Amitabha. Yes. Amitabha.
Taken to paradise. Well, surely that's self-deception, isn't it? Well, not for that.
For the ignorant one, it is of course just a pill. It is an anesthetizer. This is where you have to be careful. These mantras, these words as handed out to individuals, unintelligently used, are mere, have simply an anesthetic effect.
Once it is chosen,
they are useless as such. They are not reality. But if there is real understanding and capacity, then the situation is different. But you see, by that token, when there is understanding and capacity, there is no need for the mantra. No necessity for it at all. If I was a little bit lame and needed a stick to walk, and if I was cured of my lameness, I don't need the stick anymore. I walk on my own feet. That's that. Yes.
In bodhisattva way, it might help others.
It might. Provided we understand what we mean by help. You see, these teachings, as originally given, have come down to us through centuries, haven't they? 20 to 25 centuries. All right. And in the process of that coming down, they have had all sorts of other influences, interpretations working upon them, accretions, and all the rest of it. So you see, and then I, today, hearing it, learning it from a teacher or whatever the process may be, I am already a conditioned person to start with a mind that will interpret, with a brain that will interpret the spoken word in my way. So where am I? In the land of truth or in the land of wonderful illusions? Balloon land. This is the trouble, Sophia. This is the difficulty. She's a real teacher.
Outside, the mating ceremony.
She's the one who does the work of Saturn. You know, Saturn is the reaper. He comes with a scythe and he cuts away and cuts away and cuts away. It is like the work of the sculptor who just uses a hammer and a chisel and removes all the time, all the accretions, all that doesn't belong to the fair form of perfect measure, which is the perfect statue. That fair form of perfect measure is the product of transcendence thinking. Not a teacher teaching and a disciple learning. conditioned beings both, churning up the ocean of illusions. They are not false entirely. But they've got a bit mixed up. It is a case of being given a dish which is not only pure scrambled egg, but scrambled egg plus shell. Of course, you may like scrambled shell, but that's another matter. Now, these are the difficulties. The person who truly helps, if a bodhisattva, a wisdom being, truly helps, all that he does is to remove, to sweep clean, to bring about emptiness, the transparent condition, not ideas. Clutter the other person with ideas. Unfortunately, we have to use ideas, the spoken word and thought, in order to get rid of ideas. But now, we'll leave, that's, I think, enough for the power of the word and the mantra and the lesson we have to learn out of it. That every word we use, as far as we can possibly make it, must be true, pure, good, beautiful, loving. Bhagwan, the giver, God the giver of all good things. But how do we speak? How do we talk in our everyday life? Frivolously? A little bit diplomatically, let me put it in a nice form. Assertively? Interferingly, cattily. Is there anything like caninely to balance the cattily? Or roaring like a lion, because one is such a tremendous ego? The big boss strutting about. How do we talk? What is our speech?
Ironically enough, some were shot to provide feathers for fishing flies. Yet more were killed to provide stump ornaments for Victorian drawing.
Truthful, especially when one says to another, I love you. He or she hasn't the slightest conception, hasn't the foggiest as to what love is. He or she is aware of an upsurge of feeling. The electrochemical activity of the living organism, yes. And that is completely right for transcendence thinking, which brings into being the creature which is the animal. Then that is perfectly right. When you come to Homo sapiens, that has to be transcended altogether.
Other rivers suffer from a dirty brown sewage fungus which coats and kills the water.
You know, have you ever sort of tried to imagine
from the north, where the rivers flow through massive urban and industrial areas?
Male animal and a female animal in conversation with each other, when they are in love with each other. We have wonderful knowledge today of the courtship of animals. But now, they tell each other, I love you, in their particular way, through action, through gesture, through various natural bodily phenomena. All right? But do they know as we know, or try to know, and can they declare in words, as a thought, I love you? Now, what happens between the male and the female animal is perfection, therefore. That is love, transcendent love, having its unhindered expression there. It is in us that the cloud has appeared between transcendence and the manifestation of transcendence. This is one of the deep meanings of the fall of man. A cloud has appeared. There is a separation. We have gone away from our Father's home. So, the word spoken with intent to harm or to please is a spoilt word. The spoken word, which is the spontaneous expression of a true living relationship, a true living interaction between person and person, between he who has burnt up all evil and he who has burnt up all evil. That word spoken without any intent is the pure word. That is truth. Then the word expresses truth, is the truth. Therefore, what should I, the one who has not yet burnt up all evil, do? Perfectly straightforward answer, keep quiet. Not merely where the loudly spoken word is concerned, the audible word is concerned, but where the silent word is also concerned. You know, through the course of these years, we have now and again spent some time in meditation looking into our fantasies. You would remember that. You see? Yes, we have looked into our fantasy. And what is our fantasy like? It's always round the word I. It is completely self-oriented. It is always in terms of separation between you and me, between thou and I, always in terms of that separation. And it is always thou who comes off the worst. Never I. So you see, the silent word and the audible word. And these are things of power. This involves the whole question of relationships, human relationships. And you may remember last time we spent a few minutes meditation in connection with our relationship with things, particularly choosing an object with which we were most familiar because we used it every day in our life. Say, a cook with his cooker or saucepan, he uses that so much all his life, or a writer with his pen, or a pianist with his piano, or the taxi driver with his taxi, and so forth. That is the object. And what was the relationship between me, the taxi driver, and the taxi? We went into that, you remember. Now, similarly, we should go into human relationships. It's rather a big matter, so we won't attempt it today. Time has rather flown past. We'll do it next time. We'll start off with meditation along these, and this on this question of human relationships, you see, our relationships with other people, and have a real good meditation. But I hope that we have seen in some depth into this question of power and the word.